topping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness belts a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
Welcome to Sonic Lit. I'm Jason Camelot. I'm in the booth without Catherine McLeod today. Unfortunately, Catherine's a little bit under the weather, but I'm very happy to be here. And I've been thinking about Robert Frost lately. I mean, I had to prepare a paper for the Modern Language Association conference that happened in Toronto in early January, just last week, in fact. The MLA, Modern Language Association, is the largest literature conference in North America. Literally, thousands of people come and present papers on literary topics. And I was invited by, get this, the Robert Frost Society. Yes, there's a society of Robert Frost lovers and scholars. And because I do a lot of research and writing about poetry and performance and poetry sound recordings, and because they chose as their theme this year for their panel that happens at the MLA every year, the Robert Frost Society is granted a panel. They don't even have to propose one. They just are given one because it's the Robert Frost Society. They chose this year Robert Frost on stage. And so they thought, who might be able to talk about Robert Frost on stage, Robert Frost reading his poetry? And I was one of the people that came to mind for them. And so I was very pleased to receive an invitation from the Robert Frost Society to deliver a paper about Robert Frost as a reader. Now, I had listened to a lot of Robert Frost recordings over the years, sort of tangentially, because those recordings popped up in the context of other sound recordings that I was doing research on. But to be honest, I had not read Robert Frost in any earnest way, probably since high school. I mean, that's when we study Robert Frost, right? That's when we first get introduced to Robert Frost, if we do, if we still do. At least that's when we did back in the day when I was in high school, which is in the 1980s. If any of you have watched Stranger Things, then you'll know what my high school experience was like. It was exactly like that. In any case, we were studying Robert Frost in high school among a bunch of Canadian poets as well. And probably that's the last time I'd read him. And so months ago, as I began to prepare to present a paper, the Robert Frost Society panel at the Modern Language Association, I pulled my collected poems of Robert Frost off my bookshelf and cracked it open. I did look at the inner flap, and there was an inscription there, and it was from my older sister, Sari, and it said to Jason upon his graduation from high school, dated 1984, which is the year that I graduated high school. And that's probably the last time I looked into that book, 1984, Robert Frost, associated with high school. There's no more appropriate gift for a high school graduate than the collected poems of Robert Frost, perhaps. That's one of the things I want to be thinking about today. So we're going to listen to a bunch of Frost from different periods. Robert Frost did some of his earliest recordings in the 1930s in a speech lab, basically, that was constructed kind of like DIY style by a Barnard College professor in New York City. And he was a linguist, and he was collecting samples of American speech dialect, basically trying to develop a huge collection of recordings of people reading the same script. It was some script that had to do with rats, or the narrative involved the word rat multiple times. But the idea was to have a bunch of people from different regions of the United States read this script, and then he would collect all these different samples of people from across the United States reading this script. And then he would have a kind of bank, an archive of American dialects and speech patterns from across the country that could be studied by linguists, etc. Now, since he had this lab set up, and I should say the lab was the technology at the time in the 1930s to make records, these were early instantaneous discs. So they were lathes that they would cut records on instantaneously, and then they could play them back right away and hear them back. So whoever was recording themselves would record. It would be engraved onto, usually, and I did see these Robert Frost discs because they're held in the archives at Columbia University, and they're made of aluminum. The Robert Frost recordings, these earliest ones, are made of aluminum, and they were recorded on these aluminum instantaneous discs, recorded at the slow speed of 33 1/3, which was sort of before its time. And so William Cabell Greet, who is this linguist at Barnard College who is collecting samples of American dialect speech, also started inviting poets and writers to come in to his lab and record themselves reading poems. And Gertrude Stein made recordings there. T.S. Eliot made a bunch of recordings there. And that's what I was doing research on, was T.S. Eliot's earliest recordings of The Wasteland. But Robert Frost was also brought into William Cabell Greet's instantaneous disc recording lab at Barnard College, and he made a bunch of records. And eventually these were released by the National Council for Teachers of English as a kind of early form of educational technology. The idea was that maybe teachers who wanted to teach poetry could play some of these records in the classroom to inspire their students or something like that. And so we're going to start our deep dive into the poetry of Robert Frost with a sampling from, you know, a few of these recordings. Now, each disc would only hold about 15 minutes of sound. Sometimes if there was a longer poem, and Frost did write a lot of long poems, he wrote a lot of long dialogue poems, and some of them just wouldn't fit onto a single instantaneous disc record. And so, they were recorded in parts, part one, part two, part three, even if the poem itself wasn't divided into parts. So we're going to listen to some of these early instantaneous disc recordings of Robert Frost. Now, you should know that the sound quality of these is not hi-fi. These were mono recordings, and there was quite a lot of media noise because, well, it was recorded onto aluminum. So give these recordings a break, but they're really not that bad. And it's interesting to think about how he was reading his poems in the 1930s, and we're going to hear recordings from the 40s and 50s, and we can think about how did Frost's approach to reading change. So, something to think about.
Birches. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once they're bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterward, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have had some boy bend them as he went out or in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches.
Indeed, one could do
dust
worse.
Dust of snow. The way a crow shook down on me the dust of snow from a hemlock tree has given my heart a change of mood and saved some part of a day I had rued.
All right, I'm going to stop there for a second because we heard him, and I had a feeling, he read that poem, that first one, Birches, which is a very famous Robert Frost poem, which features an ice storm, so as Montrealers we can relate to that as well. He seemed to read it quite quickly, and I think he was a little bit worried about fitting the poem onto the disc before it ran out of time. When I was listening to those T.S. Eliot instantaneous disc recordings, he sometimes ran out of record right before he finished the end of a poem that he was reading. And so they were quite conscious about trying to time their readings to fit onto the disc. And I've heard him read Birches, that poem, multiple times at different phases in his life. And I think one of the informing factors for his reading of Birches in his 1935 or so William Cabell Greet Speech Lab recording is he was worried that he was going to run out of record. But he managed to squeeze it in, and in fact, he even had time for a second short poem. Let's hear some more of these very early Robert Frost recordings. Now, this is without an audience. Maybe just the recordist, the person who's running the lathe. But other than that, there's no one else really in the room. So these aren't live recordings from the stage. They're recorded in a lab.
The Runaway. Once when the snow of the year was beginning to fall, we stopped by a mountain pasture to say whose colt. A little Morgan had one forefoot on the wall, the other curled at his breast. He dipped his head and snorted at us, and then he had to bolt. We heard the miniature thunder where he fled, and we saw him, or thought we saw him, dim and gray, like a shadow against the curtain of falling flakes. I think the little fellow's afraid of the snow. He isn't winter-broken. It isn't play with the little fellow at all. He's running away. I doubt if even his mother could tell him, sakes, it's only weather. He thinks she didn't know. Where is his mother? He can't be out alone. And now he comes again with a clatter of stone and mounts the wall again with whited eyes and all his tail that isn't hair up straight. He shudders his coat as if to throw off flies. Whoever it is that leaves him out so late when everything else has gone to stall and bin ought to be told to come and bring him in. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
It has made all the difference. And if anyone knows any Robert Frost poem, it's probably that one. And even if you just mention the name Robert Frost, they'll say, oh, two roads converged or something like that. Or, you know, I took the road less traveled by. Robert Frost doesn't have that much respect in the Academy any longer. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for that. And we can begin to hear it possibly even in the way he reads his work, how he presents his work, as well as what his work is about, right? He writes a lot about sort of rural situations. And as we listen to him read, even in these early speech lab recordings, we can hear a kind of mixture of maybe serious, earnest, liturgical, almost sort of ritualistic sort of chanting of his poems, but mixed in with a kind of folksy, natural speech English. And that was his bread and butter in the way he presented himself and his work, that he was really a poet of the people. Robert Frost, a poet of the American people. He lived in New Hampshire. He lived in Vermont. He was a quote unquote farmer. And a lot of his early poems from the very beginning, from his first great success, which was a book called North of Boston, which is sort of where he lived, and that's where that's the part of the states that he was identified with, even though he spent his life traveling all over the United States because, you know, he won major prizes early on in his career and then sort of spent the rest of his life on visiting professorships and various kinds of cushy academic positions at different colleges across the United States. He was conferred over 40 honorary doctorates from universities all across the country. But he never really broke his persona as being a kind of folksy, earthy, rural-wise poet, right? A poet who really speaks the vernacular of, the people who are just getting by, you know, growing their own food, helping each other out in times of need, sharing tools, doing, you know, basic labor and things like that, and having, you know, basic everyday concerns, right? It's interesting to listen to Robert Frost and think about the status of these poems as, you know, sort of quote-unquote literature these days. He was a modernist poem. He was writing during the time of high modernism, both in Europe and in the States. And yet he's writing blank verse poetry, meaning he sort of stuck with iambic pentameter. So he wasn't writing free verse. He very famously, over and over again, criticized free verse as going too far. And so even though he was aspiring to achieve a kind of vernacular in the way he wrote characters and presented the lives of everyday people, he was still presenting that sort of vernacular mode using iambic pentameter lines, so lines of 10 syllables that were accented in iambic pentameter, meaning da-da, 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 da-da. Like, so if you actually scan his poems, many of his poems closely, you'll find that however folksy and speechy they may sound, they're more or less fitting into blank verse, you know, which is a pretty formal metrical structure, unlike poets like William Carlos Williams, T.S. Eliot, all of whom sort of broke with blank verse in different ways. Those are other American poets who did that and really sort of escaped metrical forms, strict metrical forms. Frost stuck with them, you know, and that may be one of the reasons that he, while, you know, still respected, still revered, is not sort of considered difficult enough or, you know, is not considered a modernist in the high modernist sense. So, yeah, we'll think a little bit more about this. And after this little break, we're going to come back and listen to a lecture that Frost gave at Breadloaf at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, which he founded sort of, I think it was in the 30s or something like that, but he continued to go back every summer. This is now it's sort of at the University of Vermont, but it's still a kind of college or program there. But that was a place that he would go every summer and just talk about writing, give readings. I don't know if he was participating in workshops, but just sort of being present. That's one of the ways he talked about how he taught best. It wasn't necessarily by lecturing. It was just by being around people, being in his presence, he said. He was not particularly modest, I guess, would benefit simply by having him around.
CJLO presents The Big M Show, a series of hour-long theatrical specials featuring all new music from local singer-songwriter extraordinaire Marlena Moore. Over the course of 2026, come on out to Theater VME for dazzling performances, each with their own unique theme, set design, and costumes. The first Big M Show is coming up on January 25th at 7 p.m. So get your tickets now to the Big M Show at mileandimprov.ca.
We're back. This is Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. I'm Jason Camelot. I'm here without Catherine McLeod in the booth today. And that's why I'm giving myself license to spend the whole show listening to and talking about Robert Frost. I don't know if Catherine would have been down for that, to be honest. And, you know, I can understand why not. And I don't want to put words in her mouth either. Maybe she would have been fine with it. Today it's Frost. It's all Frost. And it is pretty frosty out, too. It's sort of minus 13, 15. It's going to be going up to minus 22, apparently. I got a text from my partner, and she told me that they are hosing down the rink just one block away from my place here in Western NDG. And so I'm going to try to go skating later tonight. And I think that rink is going to hold up for most of the week because of the very frosty weather that we'll be facing. As I said, we're going to listen to Robert Frost now talk about poetry and education. These are sort of rambling introductions that he gave before he embarked on readings. So it's not quite a lecture, but it's like when he would appear on stage, this is when he's already in his early 80s, he was expected to, I don't know, share his wisdom as a poet. I mean, many critics like Lionel Trilling and others, you know, talked about Robert Frost as not just being a person, not having had a career, but being more like a kind of national god, a kind of figure. You know, he really was a public figure, a kind of epitome of what the poet was in America for many decades, from the early 20th century, well into the 60s. When he would give a reading, even as an elderly Frost, he was expected to share his thoughts before he engaged in reading many of his most famous poems. So here is Robert Frost from 1954 at the Breadloaf Writers Festival.
The following is a recording of a talk and reading given by Robert Frost on July 5th, 1954 at the Breadloaf School of English. He is introduced by Director Cook of the school.
It's a long time. Nice. And 29 for the other. I didn't realize that we'd been so close together. 29, you say?
29, the last
time. 35, 6 years, yes. Yep. Well, I ought to say something tonight about both poetry and education, it seems to me, under these circumstances. And I haven't done that regularly. Am I a loudspeaker here? Or is it just this that I'm talking
just
to?
That.
So I have to be careful of the crowd. All right. I haven't usually talked about either poetry or education. I've talked about everything under the sun. I can remember some of the subjects, and they were far from poetry and far from education. But I've been accused lately of having said something in print very subversive That's a funny word, isn't it? It has other connotations than I mean. But I told the story of my relation through 60 years to a particular poem of Emerson's. And a fellow teacher of mine said the other day, "I see through you." He said, "I suppose others have. They don't like to tell you. But I'm going to tell you, that's a very subversive piece of writing. It undermines education, teaching of poetry." And he said, I won't tell anybody else on you. And I said to him, "Well, I've been telling people on me for the last 40 years. So you needn't think you're telling anything special. I've been trying to tell on myself. I haven't been able to phrase it, I suppose." He seemed surprised to find it in that article. He thought he'd done quite a thing to see it himself, for himself. And he said, "I see what, I guess you mean that you don't want your poetry taught in schools. Is that right?" I said, "By the wrong people, yes." Now, it seems to me it's a chance for a little demarcation about these things. Suppose I'm thinking of the top of poetry, not my own, but the top of poetry, the Oxford Book of Verse, the Palgrave, and begin right there. And suppose I've been long puzzled, and you've been puzzled about what to do with that in school. You're most of your teachers. What would you do with the Palgrave? It was published without a single note. If I'm not mistaken, I have a very early edition of it. And what is there to say about poetry like that? Me, myself, I read Shakespeare out of my hip pocket when I was working in the mills. I never touched him in reading until then. Never really read him through. And some people tried to scare me. They said there are some of the words in that afterward, some of the words in that that look as if they meant the same as they do now, but they didn't then. There are about 50 of those, and you ought to go to college 4 years to get those, you know. And very terrible threat. Let's go back. In the 18th and 19th centuries, all education, all college education, and some high school education, was pre-pulpit and pre-parliament. All of it was. Everybody was thinking of being either a preacher or a member of Congress. And they spouted a great deal. Much of it, something of that spirit still lingers in it. There's something of that. The spouting has almost disappeared. I wish there were a little of it left. Spouting of reciting anyway, reciting poetry by heart, things like that, Shakespeare by heart. We have the word pre with us everywhere now. Medical, pre-science, pre-scientific, and pre-law, I suppose you could say some of it is. But anyway, I think that nearly all poetry that's handled in the high school and colleges today is pre-graduate school. That's the deadly thing I wanted to say. Now, that's not the least thing subversive. That's not the least thing against the graduate school. It's just that it's pre-graduate school training, not education. the college and the high school are should be kept as free as possible from all that. It's hard that it should be so because nearly all the teachers are out of the graduate school, have doctor's degrees. It's very hard for them to forget the methods of the graduate school, the scholarly methods. And most of the students that you have in the high school and college are not going to be scholars. And why should you handle them as if they were going to be scholars? Only, maybe you could say, only so that they shall respect scholars and remember to respect them when they get down into Wall Street and send plenty of money up to support them. Maybe that's the justification. But something's gone wrong. The graduate school has backed up into the high school, and even, I mean, into the college, and even into the high school. There's nothing to be said against handling Shakespeare in the scholarly fashion, but the way, that's all pre-graduate school when it's handled that way. I remember years ago, the head of the educational system in New Hampshire told me that he came into a class in the high school visiting in Concord, I think it was, or Manchester, and he found that the children reading a play of Shakespeare's, translating it word by word into other and worse English to prove that they understood it. And everything being gone into in little details. And he said to the teacher, I'll tell you the kind of man he was. He was a great teaching educational bully. He ran the whole state of New Hampshire. He once took out his watch and said to me, "I can tell you at this moment what every teacher in New Hampshire is saying." And he said, "That's because they don't, I have to supply what they shall say because they don't know what to say themselves." And he said, I went, found them going on this way in this school, and I said to the teacher, "Now that isn't the way to read a play, you know. This is a play, something you might go to in the evening, and it'd take 2 or 3 hours to see it acted." And when he said, "When I sit up a night at home when I'm not too busy, I might read a play by Marlowe or Webster or Shakespeare, one that I hadn't read before, and I'd read it the whole evening." So I'd read it. It's very readable, strangely readable. And then he said, "Of course, if you've been swept through it that way once, so you're in school, you might come back to it someday for parts that you'd like to dwell on, some of them that had charmed you especially, you know. And then if there's a little difficulties, you know, so a play will bear so much, only so much, a little poem will bear only so much of teaching, you know. If there's a little bit of things to look into, you might do that, you know, anachronisms and such things." And he said, next year he was back there, he said, and looked in on her again. And she said, "Now I'm going to open up a play for you," she said, "today." So she turned to the children and said, we're going to read Julius Caesar for rapid reading." And she said that, you know, in just the accent of "can't," you know. I heard that said once. I was crossing the campus. I heard two teachers talking in summer school, and one said to the other, "That's a rapid reading book." Something was a rapid reading book. I guess it was Walden or something like that. Then she says, "First we'll read it for rapid reading, and then we'll read it for beauty, and then we'll tend to things like anachronisms." And he says, "What can you do with anyone like that, you know? What's the hope?" Well, all I say is that I'd like to come up here sometime, another year maybe, and give four or five lectures, talks to a class on what to do how to treat poems in a high school. I won't bother with a college. That can take care of itself. But in a high school, and it doesn't matter who the poet is, taking Chaucer. There's a little that's what you might call a somewhat foreign language, a slightly foreign language that can be got over very quickly. You know, that part of it is study, of course. You're going to get over that. But the way the words are pronounced, a few weeks, and you're in there.
Just so you know, you're listening to Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. We're in the middle of a bread loaf lecture of Robert Frost talking about poetry and education that he delivered at Bread Loaf Festival in Vermont in 1954.
But I'd start the lecture by asking everybody to write down one sentence for me, just one sentence. Start four or five, and I'd make my four or five lectures out of the different words in this sentence. And they're these. Our object, speaking for the poets, our object is to entertain you by making play, symbol and metaphor, see, parentheses, by making play with things we trust you already know. That's the whole sentence. Our object is to entertain you by making play, and that's the height of it, that's the apex, by making play, and never mind the parentheses, by making play with things we trust you already know. Now, in one of the lectures, I'll modify that last, just for the fun of it, you know, that you put it, you almost know, see? Almost entirely know. There's a little something there always. You're missing with, when you write a poem or read a poem, as I am tonight, there are parts of it that one person here and another person is missing. I've been often asked in the years, how do you make children like poetry? The answer is you don't. See? You don't do it in that sweeping way. There'll be a lot of them that'll stay indifferent to poetry. And I'm not there to hoop it up for poetry. I said my friend was going, Clifford Lyons, when he's going back, giving up his deanship to teach Shakespeare again. I said, what you going to do? Going back to exaggerating Shakespeare? You know, open it up for Shakespeare. He's been advertised too much. Advertised some of us, others, you know. But that's all. That's what I'm going to do. And it's largely to sort of cleanse the high school of the graduate school approach. Now, the greatest scholarship, see? Greatest scholarship, I venerate it. And I've had good many adventures in education. I remember once hearing Nichols. He was president of Dartmouth a short time. He was a Nobel Prize man on the weight of light. And a very distinguished scholar who was not a very successful president. But I remember his saying to a lot of teachers that he wished, speaking as a scientist, he said, I wish they'd let science alone in the high school. It's just prophylactic teaching. He says they take the wonder all out of it, so there's nothing to astonish them. He might have gone on to say it's almost as bad as the comic strips, you know. It takes all the wonder out of everything. And he said, what would I have them do in the high school? He seemed to very think it as he went. He said, I'd have them, well, there's Latin. They might have 4 years of Latin, and then there's Greek, they might have 4 years of Greek. And then he thought hard, and he says, and a little mathematics. He said, I wish they'd let other things alone. He said, French and German are, you know, equivalent, you can, for your Latin and Greek. But he said, he just wished they'd let all that stuff alone, come up to the other. That's an extreme way of putting that. But I'd like to see, for the sake of the top level of poetry, can you think of anything to say of that of the what research is there for the lyrics? For instance, there's a lyric begins that in the both those books. They have most of the poems in common, those two I speak of. One that begins, the glories of our blood and state are shadows, not substantial things. There is no armor against fate. Death lays her icy hand on kings. Shadow and crown must stumble down, and in the earth be equal made with a poor crooked scythe and spade. Now at the head of that poem, in one of the books, it says, Death the Leveler. And me, myself, you see, I can say that it occurred to me after years of thinking what a beautiful title. I wondered if that was on the poem in Shirley's play where it occurs, or whether there was any title at all. This is speaking as a scholar, you see. And those things have an interest, you know, to me. I love the scholarship of it. But it's not of the first importance for the purity of what they call poesy pure, you know, pure poetry. That's what I'm speaking for. The plays are like that. They all got a first quality of entertainment, making play with things we can trust you largely to know. And if I have to say too much to prepare you for the poem, say anything to prepare you for the poem before you read it, it's too bad. If I have to say anything to you while the poem's going on, it's worse. And if I have to say anything after it, well, I hope you'll have gone home.
Well, Robert Frost had some pretty strong opinions on the state of education, especially literary education, by the 1950s. He was taking a stance against the influence of higher education, master's and PhD scholarship, and the methods they were using to study literature that he felt ultimately were getting in the way of simply understanding and experiencing literature as something that was entertaining and as something that was beautiful and edifying in and of itself. So literary work should be presented first, studied later for anachronisms and such. That's what he associates with scholarship. But I think it's a very interesting lecture, especially in the context of the kinds of austerity measures that our educational institutions are facing today. We're making big decisions about what education is, what's necessary. Of course, so many universities across North America and across Europe as well, but we're feeling it across Canada, especially recently in the United States, are being pushed increasingly towards just the opposite of what Robert Frost was sort of preaching about at Breadloaf in 1954, where programs need to become more sort of instrumental in what they're delivering as far as methods and preparation for careers go. Whereas Frost is really wanting people to understand and appreciate literature as something that helps them gain new perspectives on things that they already know, or that they almost already know, as he says. So reframing it in playful ways, so re-experiencing the world with a sense of play through language. That's really what he was getting at with his critique, I suppose, of the effects of higher education, graduate school education, especially on how poetry was being taught in the high schools, because so many high school teachers were being trained in those higher degree programs. You know, and anything that doesn't deliver in the manner that he was feeling it was important to was kind of cartoonish, or you may as well just be a comic. That brings us to this little break, and then we're going to come back and try to simply listen to Robert Frost and appreciate him for what he is.
Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Blue. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
We're back. This is Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show, and we're listening to Robert Frost and thinking about Robert Frost, and I guess thinking about Robert Frost in the context of education, how Robert Frost was taught, how Robert Frost thought literature should be taught. And we just heard a pretty lengthy kind of preamble to what was actually a reading that he delivered at Breadloaf Writers Festival in Vermont in 1954, and he was going on about the kind of negative effects of graduate school scholarship and methods that were being taught to our teachers, even as far as making its way as far down as into high school. And so sort of corrupting the experience of just basic enjoyment of literary works that he felt was paramount, the most important thing to convey to young readers of literary works. Interesting thing, I didn't play that all the way through, but right before he gets to the beginning of his reading, which is actually cut off, and I should say a lot of these Breadloaf lectures are available on the Internet Archive. Breadloaf put them up there for general listening. But he talks about, he ended by talking about how you shouldn't have to say anything about the poem before you read it. People should just be able to understand and enjoy the poem without any sort of preliminary setup. But then he does go on to talk about the poem he's about to read, which he says is one of the few poems that uses dialect. I have my collected Robert Frost, the one that I mentioned earlier, was inscribed to me by my sister as a high school graduation gift. And he's talking about this poem about essentially an axe handle, the axe helve, and how it's a dialogue between the speaker of the poem, which is sort of a Robert Frost kind of farmer poet type, and a kind of Franco-American, sort of North New England French-Canadian or French-American, Franco-American, who has a lot of strong opinions on how to make a good axe handle. And so part of that poem is written in dialect. And he makes quite a lot about how he tends not to read these poems in which he has to do these kinds of dialects, or this particular one, this Franco-American dialect, because he felt he doesn't do it well. But just remember, again, the context in which those first Frost recordings were made. They were made within the context of a lab that was collecting American dialects. And when we listen to Frost, we're hearing a kind of Northern New England dialect of sorts, and we can sort of hear it as the Northern New England rural folksy American poet dialect.
I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. There was never a sound beside the wood but one, and that was my long scythe whispering to the ground. What was it whispered, I knew not well myself. Perhaps it was something about the heat of the sun, something perhaps about the lack of sound, and that was why it whispered and did not speak.
It was no dream of the gift of idle hours or easy gold at the hand of fae or elf. Anything more than the truth would have seemed too weak to the earnest love that laid the swale in rows, not without feeble-pointed spikes of flowers, pale orchises, and scared a bright green snake. The fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. My long scythe whispered and left the hay to make. My long two-pointed ladder sticking through a tree toward heaven still. And there's a barrel that I didn't fill beside it, and there may be two or three apples I didn't pick upon some bough. But I am done with apple picking now. Essence of winter sleep is on the night, the scent of apples. I am drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break, but I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. Magnified apples appear and disappear, stem end and blossom end, and every fleck of russet showing clear. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend, and I keep hearing from the cellar bin the rumbling sound of load on load of apples coming in, for I have had too much of apple picking. I am overtired of the great harvest I myself desired. There were 10,000,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, let down and not let fall. For all that struck the earth, no matter if not bruised or spiked with stubble, went surely to the cider apple heap, as of no worth. One can see what will trouble this sleep of mine, whatever sleep it is. Were he not gone, the woodchuck could say whether it's like his long sleep as I describe its coming on, or just some human sleep.
You can hear a little bit of that alternation between the what I was calling liturgical, the kind of more grave, less speech-like, but more kind of chant-like delivery of his poems, and then... Some of the more natural speech sort of modes that he engages in. And I think that's one of the ways in which he gives some kind of gravity to the poems as he reads them. And the other thing you can hear in these poems, which are in many ways quite straightforward, he's talking about, we just heard The Pasture, a poem called The Pasture, another poem called Mowing, another one called After Apple Picking. These are very basic scenarios of observation of his environment, you know, a pasture, sort of required labor, you know, around the farm, mowing and apple picking. And he presents these poems in the first instance as very recognizable scenarios. And yet what he seems to be wanting people to discover and take pleasure in is what he would identify as the metaphorical level or even the symbolic level at which these everyday scenarios are working, so that they come to be recognized, understood as having greater significance than just the immediate scenarios of, say, observation or labor that they depict. So the three poems we just heard are more in the vein of a single speaker reflecting on certain experiences or chores that constitute the life of the speaker. The next one we're going to hear, Death of a Hired Man, which is one of the famous poems, which he did record in the 1930s on those instantaneous discs, but it took three discs, so I didn't want to play it across those three discs. This one is from a Decca recording that was made later in life, and it's the entire poem. And this one gives you a greater sense of the kind of dialogical nature of some of Robert Frost's really great longer poems.
Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table, waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed Warren outward with her through the door and shut it after her. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set them on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg or be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, then someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that were what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money in haying time when any help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to us. I'm done. Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to sooner or later. He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here, huddled against the barn door, fast asleep. Miserable sight, and frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him. And he's changed. Wait till you see. Where did you say he'd been? He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off. What did he say? Did he say anything? But little. Anything. Mary confessed he said he'd come to ditch the...
You've been listening to Sonic Lit and Robert Frost. CJLO 1690. Thanks for listening.
This is Josh Martinez reporting live from Montreal and from CJLO, the Jello radio station where electric ladies get down with the acid and the Kool-Aid and cover themselves in lovely, lovely Jello.
You're listening to CJLO News.